Shamar Joseph puts his country on his back and delivers the West Indies one of their most famous test victories ever.
Hello and welcome to the Dilip Ram All-Rounder podcast. It's the 17th of February. It's around 10:25, and in this episode, we are going to rewind only a few weeks to the 25th to the 28th of January. It's the second test between the Australian cricket team and the West Indies cricket team. And it was a very memorable match. And I usually don't do episodes which look back at matches that took place maybe a few weeks ago, but I thought this was important. I've got a great guest on today, and it's topical issues. We're going to cover a lot of great content. We're going to look at the context to that match and that series. We'll look at some of the big issues that were present there, some of the, you know, hot topics at the time. I asked my guest to look at some of the best associate nation cricketers, because I thought with West Indies not qualifying for the World Cup, arguably there's an argument that they're almost qualify as an associate nation. And we're going to look back at the best moments of that series and just look at the future of Test cricket and cricket generally. Now, I want to introduce my guest today. His name is Subhangan Nirmaleshwaran. I met Subhangan in, I think it was the middle of the 2000s, yep, if memory serves me correctly. And at the time, I knew him as a passionate South Indian classical music lover. That's how I knew him. And if you look at his LinkedIn profile, I looked at it recently. I get Subhan Nirmal as the name. But I'm going to call him Subhangan or Bangers. And his profile describes him as an IT geek, classical musician, and a teacher, which I think is perfectly described. Because when I first met him, I knew him as the New Balance sales rep. And he's now a South Indian classical music fanatic, teaching a lot of people and running a very successful career and life. He's just been married. He's a passionate, determined, and conscientious person. He's been on a huge lifestyle journey and he's looking great. Subhangan, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Now, Subhangan, I wanted to ask a first question because we are talking about sport. If you had an opportunity to play a sport at the highest level, which one would it be?
I think, they say follow your heart, but sometimes you got to take your mind with you as well. I don't think I ever saw myself as being someone that could have played sport at a elite level, simply because I think I just was not one of those kids that did exceptionally well. But funnily enough, what I wanted to do was actually, I wanted to become a sports psychologist. That was like my passion. I actually all but ended up doing it. I was actually, I was teeing up the courses and stuff, but through a series of different events that happened, I ended up going, I'll end up studying law, just like yourself.
Love it.
So I sort of went down that path, and that it's one of those things where sport has always been one of those things that I grew up loving. And, being in Australia, I think you have to grow up loving sport. So I don't think that I would have ever played as such. I never really envisaged myself as something that would have played. But I think even from a very young age, I enjoyed like the coaching side of things. I was the team manager for my year 12 team. I was involved in more along those side of things. So I think that's probably what I would have seen myself doing in sport.
Do you ever use the concept GOAT when you talk about sports or music?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's one of those things that, if anything, it's really thrown around a lot.
Almost too much.
And it was very interesting. I was listening to a talk on something totally unrelated, but it was a talk on spirituality, and it was about what they were saying was, don't assume that just because something is new, that it's not good enough as the old days, and don't also assume that just because, people often talk about the old days and the old players and the guys from back in the day, don't also assume that the folklore is around them and, whatever we've come to know about these people, like, don't also assume that, well, somebody new can never achieve that as well. So I think that GOAT discussions and all of this sort of falls upon your own perspective as well. Like, there are some people who are just emotionally attached to certain players, and they've come to the decision. I know a lot of my friends, they've like, there will never be another Sachin Tendulkar, right? And they always felt like he can never be matched or surpassed. But I think Virat Kohli, particularly in, say, ODIs, is putting up a pretty good case to say that he's at least matched, if not surpassed him in certain instances, definitely in the chase.
So if I asked you, I just walk up to you, or someone in the street walks up to you and says, who's the GOAT? And they haven't given any context. What's your answer?
I think if I had to, I'd pick Bradman, purely because I don't think I've seen any sportsman be such a statistical anomaly compared to his peers than in any other field. Mm. I think just the fact that, I mean, if you come up and say, oh, you know, Bradman, you know, he sort of didn't, if you come back with those arguments to say, okay, Bradman played in a different era, it wasn't a professional era, etc. But then all of his peers, everybody that he was playing against was also not part of that professional era.
Exactly.
So you can only realistically judge the caliber of any sports person, or in our context, music or whatever, by how this person is amongst their contemporaries based on, you know, what was available to them. I mean, the other side of it is that today's cricketers are elite specimens. Like, they, sports science has come such a long way that Everybody can run faster, throw faster, they can hit further, the guys can bowl a lot faster. Back in the day, there was one coach, right? Now there's a spin bowling coach, then there's a fast bowling coach. And
Sports psychologist. Yeah.
I missed that boat.
You haven't missed it yet. You haven't missed it. But I love that insight. I think today's generation sometimes mocks the older generation.
Yep.
And they do it ignorantly because they don't appreciate that it was a different time back then. And what I try to do in some of these episodes is to remember the past, because it's a different context back then. There's so many different things happening, and sometimes you need to appreciate what's happening in the world at that time to then have an appreciation of how the sport is played, who the athletes are. So I love that, and that's great insight.
Yeah, and just one thing to add to it also, I think that the older generation should also not mock the today's generation as well, because you have to understand that everybody is the result of the context.
Yeah.
And what they do. And, you know, you might say, oh, well, today's batsmen, they use big bats, but they're using what is available to them.
Exactly. Right. So that's in some ways, that's a good transition to what we're talking about, which is a game that was played in today's age, today's era of cricket. And it's interesting, Subhangan, because the way I thought about introducing this match, it's probably started with the comments, or infamous comments, of Rodney Hogg, who at the start of that, before the second test, said that West Indies were hopeless and pathetic. And then it somehow shifted to quotes being generated from all the cricket gurus of the world to Test cricket is alive and well. And others were saying this was, quote, the most remarkable test win that I can put my mind on, given the context. To talk about this match, we in some ways have to rewind back a year when West Indies came to Australia at the end of 2022, and they played two tests against Australia. Little fanfare for that series. I think the Australian cricket summer at the end of 22 and the end of 23 didn't have the marquee sides. We had South Africa come and basically get thrashed. West Indies came, and that two test series was a whitewash. It wasn't competitive in a real sense. And then 2023 comes, and we see that the West Indies cricket team has not qualified for the World Cup. And then they're not playing great cricket elsewhere outside of Test cricket. And so the Australian public is viewing the summer and looking at the calendar, and it says three tests against Pakistan and two tests against West Indies. Even as an ardent cricket fan, I thought it was tough for me to get excited. I'm not sure how you felt about that.
Your thoughts were exactly mine. I literally looked at that, and I remember I was talking to one of my friends about it. We've almost become conditioned to think that the Australian summer is every 4 years you get the Ashes. And then with 1 year gap, and then India seems to come. It's almost like that four-year cycle for us is like, okay, Ashes, India, these will be cracking series.
Yeah.
And then, oh, just fill in the gap. Like, you know, and I think, and I was talking to one of my friends about it, and I was like, I was subconsciously drawn to thinking along those lines. And I'm like, that is such a poor way as someone who considers himself to be a lover of sport to think. Because, you know, these guys that are coming out there to play, I mean, you know, we'll definitely touch on Shamar Joseph, but these guys that are coming out to play, they are doing their best. Right. And we also have to acknowledge that it's on a level playing field. Right. These guys, they don't have the same resources. So they're rocking up. And it's all very well for us to sit here and go like, oh, this can be a dud series. But and also, in fairness, Australia's dominance at home has just been incredible.
Yeah. Unparalleled.
Yeah. And if you really think about it, I think home dominance in test is becoming a thing. The idea that, I mean, you know, Australians once used to say that India was a final frontier because you couldn't go and win a series in India, and that was the tough thing. But if you actually look at it, pretty much every team's now become very formidable at home. It's a hard task to go and beat somebody at home in test. I will add one other thing about these kind of smaller nations and why they get these smaller things. I remember I was watching an interview with Muthiah Muralidharan. And he actually spoke very frankly about his struggles in Australia. And he said two things. He goes, when you get one guy out, another guy walks in, he's a gun. You get two guys out, you've still got Gilchrist batting at seven. And he goes, for these reasons, you know, I was just playing against this incredible team. So he mentioned that. But he also mentioned another thing, which he goes, for him as a bowler to work his way into a series, he felt that two test matches just was not enough, playing two test series. Because the thing is, and also if you've also got the other problem where your batters are not strong enough, sometimes Murali will come and play a two-match series where he'll only bowl three innings.
Yeah.
And then his thing is, so his line of thought is, it's not that he was copying out. He actually accepted that he was just playing an amazing team. But Murali goes, but it's hard to get yourself into a series because by the time you get into it, by the time you get used to these conditions, because also you're an overseas bowler, now you could turn around and say, oh, but then the Aussies are also playing two tests in that series.
Exactly.
But that's their home conditions.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah. When you consider all of those things, I think it's unfair that we do have this idea that, oh, these visiting teams are going to be duds. But to be honest, I thought the exact same thing as you did. I literally looked at this and went, well, Pakistan, I think, has not won a test in Australia in 16 years or something like that.
Longer. They haven't won since 95, 96.
There you go. I was giving,
look, you are right. And I want to cover it at the end of this episode when we talk about maybe solutions to the game.
Yeah, yeah.
But just quickly on that, I was listening to an Ian Bishop interview when he spoke to a New Zealand radio station after this series and after this game. And they asked him, they said, well, what about Test cricket? Test cricket's the pinnacle. And he made an interesting comment, which was, I think Test cricket's the pinnacle, but we have to accept for the smaller nations that there are other formats of the game that are profit-making. And Test cricket is a loss-generating exercise for most nations unless India or England tours. And I think we just have to be conscious of that for these other smaller nations, New Zealand, Sri Lanka, where if it's not India touring, then you're not making any money.
Yeah.
And that's probably why they schedule those two tests. But we will get back to that point because it's a very topical point.
Yeah.
When I think about this series, and so we have the Pakistan series, they lose 3-0 and one test was competitive, but all in all, we were left as Australian fans disappointed because I think selfishly, I wanted to see Babar Azam. Yeah. I wanted to see Rizwan. I wanted to see the Pakistan bowlers. Perhaps Pakistan's always been famous for a battery of fast bowlers.
Yeah, and just as an interesting side note as well, I think Nazim Shah is just... I watched him in the... I went to the semi-final of the T20 World Cup, and I watched this guy. Like, New Zealand won that reasonably comfortably, but I watched this guy. He just ran in, and he was just like... I really wanted to see him play. Like, I mean, losing people like him and also then... Harris Ralph, I don't know if you've seen recently, they've torn up his contract because he made himself unavailable for Test cricket. Like,
he didn't want to commit.
Yeah, and Shaheen was a little bit under the weather. Although he bowled reasonably well. Yes. I think he got better as the series went on.
Which, but then he withdraws from the third test.
You have to always treat Pakistan cricket as just this Bermuda Triangle. You don't know what's going on. You don't know what's going to come out. It's just, there's some mysterious works there. But again, to add to the point, yeah, we were disappointed also. I think had those bowlers been there, had they had their proper battery, and Australia, they've not always done well against quality fast bowling,
exactly. Aussie batting.
They haven't, right? And so I actually initially thought, I saw this, but hey, that looks like a good series. Then once these guys started to, well, I mean, injuries, you can't do anything. But then Harris Ralph not making himself available. Then I went, oh, hang on, these boys are going to get dropped. And to an extent, they did.
Yeah.
And then, like, that kind of set the scene for the West Indies, because you actually expected Pakistan to be reasonably more competitive, at least on paper, than the West Indies. And then you went, oh, geez, these guys got pumped. What's going to happen with the Windies? And then I think the first test didn't really give you a lot of confidence apart from Shamar Joseph and a couple of the quickies. They had some reasonable spells as well. I mean, Roach bowled reasonably well.
He did.
Yeah.
And it's a perfect way to describe it, because we thought the best of anything would have been that Pakistan series. It turns out to be less than satisfactory from a viewing perspective. You get to that first test, you almost are watching that test just expecting it to finish quickly.
Yep.
They play in Adelaide. Adelaide turns out, they have a great crowd there. The match finishes in 2.5 days.
Yep.
If you look at the scorecard, it looks a little closer than what it really was. I think West Indies just never really had a shot with the bat. But then you move to that second test, and a lot of us probably were thinking what we said, which is, let's just get this over and done with. Move to the next series. Australia's going to be playing New Zealand, and that will probably be a more exciting series. And I had very low expectations. I thought it was interesting. It was good that there was a pink ball test.
Yeah.
The pink ball test, I think, is a good way in which to reinvigorate test cricket in some ways.
Yep.
It brings that concept of one, you know, day-night matches into test cricket. It adds an element of uncertainty and surprise with the third session almost always favoring the bowling team.
Yep.
Yeah. And it just keeps it interesting. And I thought the other thing that helped was that India and England were playing at the same time. And the reason I say that is, I think that's where test cricket's at its best, when you've got two simultaneous series going on.
Yep.
And it allows fans to just click through, and you're entertained for the whole day with test cricket, which is something that I think we all love and enjoy.
I think that's what makes us nerds. I mean, that's proper nerd stuff right there, right? Like, you're saying, like, I know people that can't sit through a session of test cricket, but we are saying, hey, I want to watch three sessions of this, then move on to another three sessions, because that's the best life, right?
Yeah.
Just also to add to that as well, my own personal thing was, I remember West Indies won the toss, they batted. And I was like, oh, well, naturally, you always think that when the weaker team wins a toss and bat, then you think to yourself, okay, this game's going to progress reasonably quicker than it was. And also the dominance of Australia in day-night test matches. The fact that they're coming off on the back of, you know, the World Test Championship win, retaining the Ashes, winning the World Cup. Like, this team was just on a roll.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, I didn't post this, and I was like, I remember thinking I should post. Okay, first day, second test. Thanks to the Windies for batting first, so that we can all get this all done and over with. But I would have just, I just go, the amount of flack that I would have copped from my mates had I posted that, and you know, in what turned out to be, and that was like literally like how I was thinking.
Yeah, but you know what's funny is that Rodney Hogg was quite fairly criticized after the game. And I think none of us actually probably would have remembered his comments if not for Craig Braithwaite at the end of the match speaking about how those comments motivated him. But I think that's how a lot of us felt. I think if you asked a lot of people just before that game what they thought about this match, maybe they might not have used pathetic and hopeless, but they would have said this is going to finish in 2 days. It's not competitive. It's one of those comments that will live famously because he was so wrong about the result. But it's hard to deny that most people, if you ask them privately, may have had similar feelings about the outcome of this test match.
To be honest, I think too much gets made of these things, right? And this is my thought process. History is always written by the victors, right? This is not the first time that the West Indies have been written off in a match or a series or just West Indies cricket in general, right? They also didn't qualify for the World Cup, right? Which is like, this is a team that won the first two World Cups.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is just like the thoughts that during the lifetime of the people of the ilk of Sir Vivian Richards, that their team cannot make this, like, qualify for a World Cup is ridiculous, right? To be honest, it's also a little bit like, oh, come to the Gabba, like these kind of comments, right? It's all great when somebody wins and then they can use that to say, I use it as motivation. But I mean, you mean to tell me that Braithwaite has not heard any other criticism, whether it's come from his own quarters or his own former players? I mean, there was a, I can't remember the keeper. He was like, you know, that he held up the sign, talk now wave after he scored 100. I was like, yeah, you've scored 100, but you've also not contributed. Like these sorts of things to me, it's all nice to have those kind of moments, or whether you've just dropped the World Cup, these kind of things, you have these moments where you just kind of go, okay, and then you can turn around and go, I use that as motivation. But I'm pretty sure these guys, they read everything that's written about them in the paper. They read everything that people say, and they hear all the comments. And it's just one of those things where I think they just got up and they went, yeah, we remember that comment. Like, that's
you need take. You need some things to motivate you sometimes. Yeah. And as much as we criticize players for, we want players or journalists to be honest.
Yep.
With us, but then at the same time, we don't want them to be honest if it goes against what we believe or what we view. So in this sense, it just helps with, it generates articles, it generates clicks, yep. And it's good for the sport ultimately, yep. These comments.
And I mean, and also it's like nobody ever reports on if somebody gave like a standard, boring, like, hey, run off the mill, or the boys played well today, it was team. But like, come on, like.
Sounds nobody, like Inzema. Yeah. Boys
played well. You know what I mean?
It's
just like, it's also these things, they stick out. And also these guys, I'm pretty sure Rodney Hogg isn't sitting there having a cry, because I don't think I've remembered the name Rodney Hogg mentioned that many times in the last couple of, so for him, Rodney Hogg might be the next person that gets called up. Like, this is how this media and this is how social media and all of these things work, right? It's just like sometimes just for clicks and views, and people can say any outlandishly stupid things. I mean, remember Glenn McGrath, right? Every Ashes, what was his prediction? 5-0.
5-0. And he would say how he would get, who his bunny would be for the series. But we loved it.
We loved it.
It was all part of that build up to the series. It made it exciting.
Yeah. And just on that, can I add one more thing as well? I find that nowadays players, maybe not that they are more sensitive or that. I think we as a generation are better at expressing our feelings. And you know, back in the days as well, like these, I think the comments and criticisms are actually a lot more harsher and a lot more less refined and more brutal. And the players just copped it and they went on, and it was almost this idea also that you have to be macho and that you got to be a man's man and you don't retaliate, you don't retort. But now people are actually like saying, no, that's not on. And you know, I mean, there's now people are at least drawing certain lines in sledging, and you go, don't drag family into it, this kind of stuff. So I think the other side of it is, I think the players are also, now players have a platform to come in and talk. They can use social media. They can have a win. So I think that's also adding to that as well. So
I think that's key. Yeah. I think it's just that back then, players, athletes generally didn't have a platform to respond quickly to things. But now if a player takes issue with something, you will hear from them instantaneously.
Yeah, yeah.
And that generates clicks. It also generates buzz and discussion, but it can sometimes go the opposite way and be toxic for the sport. There's no real line there.
Yeah.
But it's something that's constantly up in the air as to how much of that is good for the game and how much of it is not. Hot seat to Mangan. I had a couple of points I thought in the lead up to this match were tricky debate points or topical issues. The first one I had, in a funny way, was the Gabba, which had been seen as this fortress for Gabba Australia. The Gabbatoir. We'll see you at the Gabba. And you mentioned it, but Australia had not lost a test match prior to the India series, which was a couple of years ago. They hadn't lost to the Gabba for a long, long time. I think since it might have been, I think West Indies or England may have beaten them, and then they hadn't lost for 25 odd years.
Yeah.
And then the India chases a big total in 2022. And we now come back to the Gabba. I thought Gabba's on the hot seat because Australia wants to rediscover its winning methods here, and let alone we find out that they don't.
What's the commonality between the West Indies and the India series about when the Gabba test was hosted?
It was hosted in... Well, this one was a night test, though.
But still, it was the last test.
Last test of the summer.
Of the summer.
Good point.
One of the things that a lot of people do not factor in is that the Gabba is the first test of the summer. And if you look at all of the various pitches, each one's got its own qualities, right? Gabba generally seems in the start. And most teams, what happens is that when they come on, you take a little bit of time to get used to the bounce, which is going to be there. So when you start at the Gabba, you've got seed movement. And Shane Warne had a cracking record at the Gabba as well, because it will then break up and spin. Like, it is about the most quintessential perfect Australian pitch. So usually when that test is the first of the summer, and it's not the legend of the Gabba is one thing, but it's also generally been the first test of the summer. So people are coming in, and they're going to get drubbed anyway. Like, as in, the chances of them getting drubbed at the Gabba are pretty good because of the fact that, you know,
it's different bounce. They've played one first class game. They're not used to the conditions.
Yeah. And so that's something that people don't factor in, right? And then the other thing is also certain grounds lift certain people as well. The Gabba is a beautiful ground. Like, it is one of the most beautiful grounds in the world. So it's like, you know, it's interesting that England's, if you look at the averages of England players, England batters at the Lords, versus visiting players, you'll actually find a lot of visiting players will do very well because they pick themselves up because they want to get onto the Lords.
The honours board, yeah.
Right? So there's these factors as well that people, I sometimes think that they neglect as well. So when you look at the Gabba and the dominance, I think you have to also take these into consideration.
It's a good point about the last test. The Gabba being the last test on those two occasions where they lost, as opposed to the first test. It's a real change in, I suppose, Fortress Gabba it's a fortress because it's the first test you play. You're not used to the conditions.
Yep.
Whereas if it's played as the last test, you've now gotten used to Australian conditions, the Australian soil, the Australian bowlers. Perhaps you're more comfortable.
Yeah, and I think like the Wacker of the old, the 70s and the 80s Wacker, that's probably the only unplayable pitch, or the pitch that you go is a difficult pitch. I don't think that the Gabba was ever difficult. If anything, I believe that the Gabba is the best Australian pitch because it's got something for everybody, right? It's got seam. You know, in the first 1.5 sessions, quicks will do well. Batsmen are always happy because it's even bounce. It doesn't get like up and down like Sydney does on days 4 and 5. Not that we get to days 4 and 5 these days anyway, but you know, so you've got these sorts of you've got these sort of factors. And I don't necessarily think that Gabba, the fortress, was the fortress necessarily because it was a difficult pitch to play in, or only the Aussies knew how to bowl or bat on the Gabba or anything like that. Whereas if you said that about, had it been, say, Perth, had Perth been that fortress, and then you go, well, yeah, I mean, look at the bounce. I mean, most people can't get used to that bounce, and no subcontinent team will be able to get used to that bounce right away. If you said that, I go, there's something about the pitch. I just feel like there's external factors that came together. That's my thoughts.
Great call on the Gabba. So that was number one. Number two I had was opening batsmen. And I had opening batsmen on the hot seat because we had two teams here with opening bats that were under scrutiny. One was Craig Brathwaite, the captain for West Indies, and the other was Steve Smith, who was assuming the role as opener because David Warner had announced his retirement at the end of the Pakistan series as a test match batsman. And Smith said, I'm happy to open. It'll give me an opportunity to score runs at the top of the order. Happy with that. But he found it challenging in that first test against the West Indies. And even after one test, I think there were some comments in the media from the likes of Michael Vaughan, Mark Waugh, and others who were just saying, well, it's not as easy when you start opening the batting, and his technique was starting to let him down in certain quarters. So I just thought it was interesting that on both sides we had these two, I wouldn't call Brathwaite a great batsman, but we had these two players who were establishing their team that were starting to be called into question.
Yeah, and I think with the Stephen Smith, I think he answered himself. He said, average 60, what's the problem? Right? That's what he said at the end of the series.
Yeah.
True. Look, I think I never thought of it as, would Steve Smith bat well as an opener? For me, I think, you know, the famous Justin Langer quote, which is that he's the greatest problem solver. The guy, I mean, he scored runs in India, he scored runs in England, he scored runs like when it mattered against top ball. I just like, and also when you bat, and he batted at first drop for quite a while before Marnus came in. Right? True. If you're batting first drop, they say that you're a de facto opener because you know that it's highly likely that you're going to be in one for one after two overs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So is it that much of a difference for me? I didn't think it was that. I saw the problem as slightly differently, which is that, well, Stephen Smith is an experienced and he's an all-time great and he's going to lock down number four. He's also in his mid-30s, right? Mm. He's not going to be around for a very long time. And the other side to me was Khawaja is also, well, Khawaja is actually a bit older. Khawaja's not going to be opening the batting, I wouldn't think, in 4 years' time.
No.
Right? So I saw this as an opportunity of getting in a young opener to bat with Khawaja for 2 years, do a bit of an apprentice and be an understudy. And then when Khawaja retired, this said, you know, the new opener can become the experienced opener and you bring somebody else in. And this is how you do a transition, right? Mm. That was what my concern was. I didn't think that Stephen Smith will bat at 11 and he'll score runs. Like
it's a good point, and it maybe speaks to the mindset of the Australian selection committee.
Yep.
Which is they in recent years have been reluctant to just blood in a young opener for the fear that they will not succeed initially and then they'll be put back into the wildlife and will struggle to rediscover that initial promise, which is what brought them to the team. And you've seen the likes of Cam Green, who's been now in and out of the team for a while. He's seen as this young superstar that would stay in the team forever. And then now Mitch Marsh has almost superseded him as the number one all-rounder. That's not to say that it can't happen, but I just think perhaps this selection team has valued maturity and experience over the youth. But that's not to say that can't change in the future. The last one I had was just, but I had Shamar Joseph on the hot seat. And the reason I had him on the hot seat was we've seen players bowl a good spell on debut or early on in their career and then fall away. I think I distinctly remember a few West Indies players and other teams, other players from other teams have a great spell. The world talks about them and then they never achieve that same glory. I remember Lou Vincent scores 100 against Australia in Perth in 2000. We never consider him to be an established or great cricketer of the game. I think Fidel Edwards had that sort of initial burst and then falls away. So Shamar takes 5 wickets in that first test. At least I put him on the hot seat because I wanted to see more of him. People had spoken about him and I wanted to see if he could continue that form into the second test. That's why I had him on the hot seat.
One of my concerns in getting into Gabba was also, the other thing was, he was the best player in the first test for them by a country mile. And had it been, say, Akima Roach, and he showed a little bit of promise, then you go, you expect Roach to back up and perform. But I did not expect him to back up and perform at all. Like, I thought that he might have the odd good spell in the innings. That was one thing. And then when he got the Sandshrew Crusher, I was like, this dude's gone. And I go, there goes the test. I turned around and
went, done.
There goes the test. I literally said those words.
Yeah.
Right. And especially, I think they got to 1 for 60 in the Australia's second innings just before the end of play.
Which we'll get to, yeah.
And also, he hadn't bowled during that session, so it looked like this guy was out. And I'm like, they're done for, right? So you didn't expect that guy to come back and bounce back. But it also is, all of these things happen. I mean, there's also reasoning for it. For one is, even if somebody does really well, like, you know, going into the test, I mean, how sport has transformed. Now it's like, it's no longer like, it's no longer, hey, mate, you ball first change. Okay, you ball second change. Like, there's now combinations. It's like, they look at a batsman or a bowler and then they'll go, this guy bats like this, this guy balls like this. We will change the batting order so that, you know, when he's at his freshest, we're not exposing this bowler. Like, you know, that level of thinking is happening. So I think that's one of the reasons why people can't back up, because usually, like, I mean, the guy, he played like 5 first class games before he came into his first test. So Australia could never have really studied him or read him or done anything because there was no information.
Exactly. There's a lack of data around him. And I suppose it's just on that point. One thing I probably want to celebrate about Shamar is his story, which has probably been spoken about numerous times since this first and second test. And he comes from a very poor background. He moved jobs outside of cricket before he got into cricket. He was a security guard. He moved within the West Indies island of, like, you know, those various nations. He was moved to Guyana, gets found by certain cricket coaches in Guyana. He takes part in a Curtly Ambrose bowling academy. He gets found, gets
fast-tracked.
Yeah, fast-tracked into the cricket setup.
Mm.
And the one thing he has is heart and pace.
Yep.
And sometimes that can take you everywhere.
Australia's done that too. Pat Cummins.
Yeah.
Josh Hazlewood. Both of them did not have, I mean, especially Cummins.
Yeah.
They did not have like very long storied first class records. And no. I think it tends to happen more with bowlers than with batsmen. If you really think about it, it's very, very few batsmen will get chucked in for test cricket. But with bowlers, you kind of are able to, only because I think the reason is the batsman only gets away, make one mistake per innings.
Yes.
Whereas a bowler, you can be like, look, you could bowl 4 rubbish balls, but if you're going to pick up 2 wickets, like he's a weapon, right? He's got the pace. You back that. You back the fact that he's got the pace and he gets reasonable bounce. And you just back him and you just go, you know what, just run in and bowl your best. And look, you might get pumped, but then so is all the experienced bowlers. So at least your wicket-taking ability, and I think that's what they identified in him very early on, and I think that's such a fantastic story. I think he's read somewhere you have to do like a 225-kilometer boat ride or something to get to his village. His village was very small, and, you know, he was working as a security guard. He was working like within the forest or something.
Yeah.
Very nearly escaped death, and
yes.
You know.
Yeah, it's a story that we should celebrate, and it's what keeps us fans of cricket, because often we love the performance, but we love the backstory.
100%. And I think also, again, you got to kind of think back to those islands, the whole collection of those West Indies islands. And obviously they're not all at the same levels of economic parity. So when a Shamar Joseph comes in from those humble backgrounds, like, what sort of effect is that going to have on kids that grew up or now will now see, oh, hey, this guy that was, you know, from a humble village, if he can do that, I can do that. Like stories like Makai Antini.
Oh, I know.
Like, you know, or even Lasith Malinga. Lasith Malik, like these kind of players, when they come through, they inspire a generation afterwards, and you'd see the impact now of Makaya Entini with some of those cricketers that are coming through the system.
Exactly.
Some outstanding guys. And there's like copycat Malingas. I mean, good prospects. Like I think there's Pathirana, who's playing for CSK, like people are wanting to not just emulate what they do, but bowl exactly like them as well.
Well, exactly. And I think sometimes we underestimate the importance of seeing someone with your skin color or your background playing for a nation. It gives the youngsters and even people in their 20s hope that, or belief that if they can do it, you can do it. And that sometimes is crucial. Like just you mentioned Entini. Mm. The one story I always remember about Makaya Entini is if you watch him bowl, you would always know that the way he used to bowl, he would bowl onto the pitch and then run off the pitch immediately.
Yep.
And probably everyone knows this story, but it was that when he was younger, he couldn't afford cricket shoes. And they gifted him cricket shoes in order to be able to play cricket. He didn't want to ruin those shoes.
Yep.
So he would quickly bowl and then run off the wicket because he thought that the wicket and the pitch would damage his shoes. So just stories like that just show you how cricket can change people's lives and how it formed. It's absolutely always important to look back at
just an add-on to those individuals. Jayasurya, you know how he used to fiddle with his pads and stuff. And apparently, the reason for why it was when he was young, like he couldn't afford to get the right pad size, so he had to use like what was available, which is like bigger. Of the bigger kits, so it would never stick on. So you always had to adjust in between each ball, and that carried all the way throughout. I mean, you know, he wasn't. He was the first big signing for Mumbai after Sachin, obviously being an icon player. Like, even at that stage, even all the way throughout, it carried on. And exactly. It's just funny how these stories kind of come out and shows you. That's the beauty of cricket, right? Like the characters, the players, what they bring, their stories, and the way that this then ends up inspiring people in so many walks of life. I mean, we say that Shane Warne made bowling sexy, or you talk about Usman Khawaja now. What he's doing as as an ambassador for the multicultural nation that Australia is, and what he's showing to the other kids, hey, you know what, you can be different and yet still be a part of this setup.
Yeah.
I think that's huge.
Should we get to top five moments?
Yes, sir.
Let's not beat around the bush. They were hopeless. We should have two divisions now. We can't have these weak sides coming out here. Mitchell Starc with a brand new pink ball, he's going to run straight through them. So I wouldn't think the game would go any further than 3 days. They're pathetic. Well, I look back at the West Indies of old and we're down stretching on the ground and they're running past in speedos and I'm going, gee, look at their muscles. These days, the West Indies, they'd be running past in overcoats.
Bangers, top five moments.
Mm-hmm.
I want to race through a couple of them that really set up the match, but it's a match that I think the fifth moment for me started with the partnership on day one between Joshua De Silva and Sinclair. In some ways, they are the authors of that win because they give West Indies a large enough total that keeps them in the game and keeps the match competitive. I think when you think about Test cricket, and I don't have the stat for this, but if the first team batting first scores more than 300, more likely than not, they're going to win the game.
Yep.
And I thought that partnership was crucial because West Indies were in trouble and it brought them back to a total that they could defend.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, the other thing was, I think when you're a batting unit and you got the team 6-7 down and then you're out there, like that frustrates. It's almost like this idea that how dare the bowlers keep us out here. And it has the other flow and effect of, say you quickly finish the innings, the bowlers get a reasonable rest, they come back, they're more fresher, but you keep them there and you keep holding them further and further away, you're frustrated, then they bowl worse, then they won't get him out. So it's like it plays on that.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly. Yep. So West Indies put on a very competitive first innings total.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth moment I had was Kemar Roach's 3 wickets in the first innings and Australia being 4 for 24. When Australia was 4 for 24 with Roach on fire and Alzari taking a wicket, you could hear it in the commentary team as well. I was watching a lot of the KO commentary. So you had Brendan Julian, Isha Gua, Kerry O'Keefe just making jokes left, right, and center, Mark Waugh. And you could see almost hear the excitement in their voices that we've actually now got a test match that is competitive, is interesting. And regardless if you're an Australian fan, you almost want the West Indies to do well. So when West Indies had them 4 for 24, you could really sense the optimism and excitement in the viewing public.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we want to see that. Like, watching Australia win game after game is not fun. We still want Australia to win every single game. It's just you want it to be competitive. And and also watching Kemar Roach as well. Like, Kemar Roach is a guy that I think he's now played 80 odd test matches for West Indies. And he has actually, you know, West Indies players often get criticized for taking other franchise cricket over the thing. And he, you know, he's toiled, he's done it. And I think Brian Lara also made a good comment as well on commentary when he was just saying, like, you know, he's been a good servant for West Indies cricket. And I think that's why, like, and I mean, I've watched him probably about 10 years ago. He's been playing for a while, sure. And so to see that guy come back and do well was just a happy moment as well, I think, for all of us.
You called it right, and I think he's an elder statesman of the sport. His record isn't great, but that doesn't mean these great elder statesmen can't always perform on the odd occasion.
Yep.
The next moment I had was Australia's declaration. The reason I had it was, I think it was an important declaration. It shows the intent of the Australian team, which is even if they had not reached West Indies total, they still felt comfortable enough to declare at that time. And it brought that intrigue of the day-night test match because Australia wanted a few overs to bowl at West Indies under the lights with the pink ball. It's a moment that's not, probably won't be remembered in time, but it just showed the attitude of the Australian team, which I don't think, maybe apart from England, I don't think many other nations would adopt that very aggressive approach.
Absolutely. And also, Pat Cummins was 64 not out. He was in the middle. He had some momentum. But I think Pat Cummins' captaincy overall copped a lot of flack early on. He, you know, a lot of people didn't like the new book, Test Captain of Australia. That's another discussion point. But also, I think he was found out in, I think, the second Ashes test. Like, he was accused of being a little bit not proactive enough. And I think he has really come on into that role, you know, particularly since that Ashes match and then the World Test Championship, the World Cup, how he led the team. Remember, he got them back into that match against Sri Lanka. If they lost that match, they would have been, that whole World Cup campaign would have been. So to me, I'm seeing that was a beautiful moment of how good and a proactive and a winning mindset that Pat Cummins and Australia has had. Look, yeah, they lost the match by not much, but if you were to also look at the other side, is they did get one wicket after that declaration. Maybe they might not have gotten that wicket in the first. You don't know all of these things as
you,
well.
You don't know. You don't know. My second best moment, and it's, look, you can't call it a best moment. I'll call it a memorable moment because it creates the storyline for the final day. It's that Yorker. You picked it early. You said it. That Yorker, when you look at it and the reaction that Shamar Joseph had, you felt that he may have been out for 3 months with a need requiring toe surgery and not being able to play cricket for a long time. It would have been a disappointment because we had so much excitement for what his potential could bring. And you hear Shamar Joseph speak about that moment. He says he went to get x-rays, to get scans. He himself thought he wouldn't play another, wouldn't even enter the field again for that summer. And lo and behold, the opposite takes place. But I just thought that moment, it's a poignant moment because it's set up hundreds of articles for the future about how he was able to miraculously recover and win a match for the West Indies.
But these are the stories that add to the folklore, right? I mean, we don't just want to see them come up against the odds on the scoreboard. Like, we want to see them fight the elements. Like, you know that Dean Jones double hundred, the famous Dean Jones.
In Chennai.
In Chennai, right? Yeah. Like,
Or Madras, like,
yeah,
at the time.
Madras. Like, you know, like, this is the thing. We want to pretend that our sports people are almost like warriors. Like, this goes back to our, you know, our condition of watching at the Colosseum and watching people. Like, I feel like, yeah, these things just add this beautiful element, fighting the element. So sometimes, you know, you hear stories about, oh, look, you know, I think Maxi had an hour of sleep the night before that Afghanistan double 100 because he was with the baby. Like, they add such a nice element to it. Obviously, I watched it and I thought, this guy's not playing cricket for another 6 months. And I go, finally, they got a good prospect. Thank you, Starkey.
Exactly. The number one moment, rather than pick out a wicket, I just want to celebrate Shamar Joseph's his bowling innings. Mm. Australia enter day four, 2 wickets down. Cam Green and Steve Smith are looking fairly solid.
Pretty solid, yep.
They're chasing a total of 216 runs, which in the scheme of things is it's a challenging total. Anything over 200 on a day, in a fourth innings is not straightforward, but it's not a total that you would expect Australia to struggle with, particularly against a waning West Indies attack.
Yep.
And Shamar Joseph comes in. We weren't expecting him to bowl, and he takes 7 of the most fiery wickets. You can see, it's not often that a bowler comes to Australia and destroys the stumps at the frequency in which he did it.
Yep.
It was a spell that I will never forget. We probably both watched it live. We heard the commentary, and I don't know, it's a sign of today's generation, but I'm watching the game. I'm watching him bowl, and I've got my phone in my hand, and I'm just scrolling Twitter just to feel as if I'm part of that online community of just, we're all watching it together, and I wanted to see the reactions. It was that sort of spell.
Yeah. And I think within that whole moment, I will pick one moment out of that, because I think that was a nail in the coffin, was the wicket of Travis Head.
Yes.
Because he just bowled Cameron Green, and then he bowled. Now, there's different ways to get a wicket. It all comes out as a wicket on the scoreboard. But if you get a guy who's tickled the ball down the leg side, and then like everybody almost feels like that, like the batsman was morally robbed of his wicket. Like, it's like it is out. It's 100% out. But it's like, oh, but then if it hits like on the outside of the wicket for an LBW, and you say, but there is nothing that raises a team like clean bowling top order batsman. He got Cameron Green, right, and then you went, all right, here we go. Travis Head, man for the crisis.
Exactly.
Right? And he, you know, he stepped up in the World Test Championship. He stepped up in the World Cup final. He's literally stepped up every single time Australia's asked of him. And he also played well in the previous match, right?
Yeah. Scores 100,
saves Australia in the first innings. Right? And then for him to then come in and to clean him up, I thought, and how it happened, when it happened, the way it happened.
The celebration.
Yeah. And that was when I thought, they've got a sniff here.
Yes.
Like that moment was my moment when I went, oh, they've got a sniff here.
You're so right. They're 4 down then.
Yeah.
The pessimistic side of me thought the only time I felt they had a sniff was when they were 9 down. I've seen this Australia team.
Yeah,
but getting Travis Head out, it was momentous because of what you said. He's carried Australia for a long time in those big matches. He was, you know, if I use an Indian example, we always saw VVS as a batsman who raised his level when he played the big teams.
Yep.
Well, Travis Head has done that on the big stage in all these moments. And look, Shamar finishes with, was it 7? He finishes with 7 wickets for 68. It's an expensive 7 in terms of his strike rate, but nobody cared about that because he was there to take wickets. And it somewhat reminded me that spell of some other spells in world cricket. You had Devon Malcolm take 9 for 57 against South Africa. And in that spell, rather than being yorked, he was hit in the head and said, I'll see you guys in the fourth innings. Or at least that's what the folklore has told us he said. And Fanny de Villiers took 6 for 43 against Australia in the early 90s in 94. And then we had Amar Jamal in the second or third test take 6 for 111. Just reminded me of those spells where if you're a bowler who bowls with 100% heart, you will do well in Australia. Sometimes you won't get the rewards, but when it does work, it works well.
You've forgotten the 7 for 2 or something.
Oh, Ambrose. 7 for 1 at the Wacker. But his name at the time was, he was still very well known.
True. I mean, he was always, you poked the bear there. Yeah. There is a distinction because these guys are fairly unknowns that have sort of come in. I do remember very early on a spell that Ishan Sharma bowled to Ponting.
Yes.
That was...
I think he was at the Wacker.
Yeah. And that was kind of... It was only after then I think people took Ishant seriously as a bowler.
Like, he's very young.
He was very young. And then. He was quick.
He had bounce.
But again, it also comes down to that if you were a person with that kind of caliber of quality of cricket, I think you lift when you come to Australia.
100%. Right?
And also, I mean, most of these players come from, I mean, leave out the English players. They come from places that don't have the same amount of bounce.
Yes.
So you come in and you see, now the problem that also happens in most fast bowlers, they see the bounce and then they go, I'm just going to just bowl bounces all day. The ones that are smart enough to pitch them up, like if you look at it, most of these guys, they pitch them up, and the ones that are smart enough to pitch it up, they're the ones that succeed as well.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And it brought to a conclusion a fantastic test match. Have I missed any big moments in that game?
No, I think the only other thing was was Stephen Smith's 92.
Good shout out.
Right.
Yeah. 92 not out.
Not out. Not yeah. out. First of all, should be considered out because if you are letting Hoff face balls... That's just wrong. You don't let Hoff face balls. Like, come on, man. What was he thinking?
it's interesting how certain players, they adopt different approaches. Some batsmen will say, I'm going to take strike every time. And then others give confidence to the other side. But then when you're chasing, when the target is coming closer and closer, you almost feel like you need to be.
Yeah. But this was the Steve Waugh theory that they used to call it, the famous Steve Waugh theory, which is that he would actually go in and tell all the bowlers, you need to actually learn to bat and you'll make sure that they prepare. And look, he hasn't had the best time, but there's been times when he's hung around at least. So you can't really blame him. And he was looking reasonably okay up to that point when he took that single.
I'm glad you mentioned the 91 or 92 not out, because it's very rare for an opening batsman to bat through.
Yes.
And I looked quickly at the record of who bats through. And some of the names, if you've got Tom Latham, Dean Elgar, Alistair Cook, Pujara when he opened, Karuna Ratne. But a lot of those players were defensive stalwarts who value their wicket, and that was shown in Steve Smith's innings as well.
He also played that reverse sweep. Did you? Like, I was like, first of all, like, what? Since when?
He wants to be in that 2022.
I've never even seen him play that in the T20. But for me, that innings was really important because this was the great man coming back and going, "Hey, I'm Steve Smith.
I'm the best player in the world."
Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Oh, so everybody else struggled, but I got to 92. And he didn't look like he was going to get out. I don't think he was dropped. Like, he didn't look... Like, he looked fine.
If I can compare myself to Steve Smith for the only time in my life, the greatest joy I had as a cricketer prior to a few years ago was in year 10 when I played in a 10-A's match for my school. A New Zealand side had toured our team, our school, and we were all out for 132 and had 66 not out. And the joy you get when you walk off the pitch and your teammates are all saying, the spinner took 7 for 15.
Yeah.
And they're all saying, oh man, we couldn't play him. And I'm walking off saying, mate,
exactly.
Can someone bat with me?
Yeah, exactly.
Selfishly, it's one of those moments where when you open and you bat through an innings, there's no other joy that you get.
100%.
I want to do a few, would you believe that's with you, Shubhangan, before we finish off with some topical current cricket news. And I want to, before we do that, I just thought there are 170 cricketers that have taken a 5-wicket haul on their debut in a test match. 10 of them have been by West Indies players. Travis Head, King Pair, There are 23 king pairs in Test cricket history. The last, do you know who the last cricketer was before Head to get a king pair?
Last Australian?
No, just last cricketer. Well, this is a tough one. I wouldn't have picked it. It was Sam Curran. He had a king pair at Lord's against India in 2021.
Jeez. Okay. I know the three Aussies that have got one.
Yeah. Who are they?
Gilly.
Against India.
Which you know. And obviously Heddy.
Some questionable LBWs.
But the one... But the one that you wouldn't think of is Ryan Harris.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Ryan Harris. Okay.
Not that he was a particularly great batsman or anything, but it was just more the fact that he'd be in that set.
Yeah. And then otherwise I was looking at just players who really excelled on debut. And I know this was Shamar's second test, but Albert Trott, who played for Australia and England, he holds the record for the best bowling figures on debut, 8 for 43. And six bowlers have scalped 8 wickets in an innings on debut. Bob Massey and Hirwani are two that feature twice in that list. And Jason Crazier, I remember. Yep, he was another one, 8 for 215.
Yeah, yeah.
But it just shows on debut, if there's little data or little video, then as a bowler, you can succeed at the highest level.
You can. I think another stat that I saw was that was the first time that Australia lost a day-nighter.
Yes.
Day-night test.
Yes.
They had played 11 consecutive day-night test matches. The dominance of Australia and also Mitchell Starc in those day-night test matches, it was almost one of those things, turn up, you get pumped, and you go home, right? And the fact that this team of all the teams, and remember, I think that this was the one where they rubbed Australia, I mean, India out for 36.
Yes.
That was a day-night test match as well. I mean...
That's a bad memory for Indian fans.
Like for a lot of cricketers, like a lot of very good cricketing nations, they've just not been able to match it with Australia in a day and night test. I thought that was a really important stat.
That's a great stat. Subhangin, I want to shift and finish off with just a quick discussion with you about the modern game and a list that I've asked you to think about. So before I get your views on the future of cricket, which I love to do. I love to speculate and hypothesize about how we can fix the game that we all love, notwithstanding that after every test match we watch, we get commentators saying test cricket's back, test cricket's the greatest. But before I do, the West Indies performance got me thinking about the quality of the associate nations in cricket. And I don't put West Indies as an associate nation, but I think the frank reality is that their current state is that of an associate nation side, notwithstanding this win.
Yep.
And I want to celebrate some of those associate nations. So I've got you to think about the top five greatest associate nation cricketers of all time. And I said you can include Bangladesh and Zimbabwe because they were once associate nations.
Yep.
But you can only pick one player. So give me your top five.
Okay. Top three, I don't think anybody would have any issues with, as in from my top five.
Yeah.
Andy Flower, Zimbabwe.
Yes.
Special mentions to the late heat streak. I thought beautiful. He was, you know, all of those qualities that we talked about, running in hard, that he was all of those things.
Great action.
Yeah, just great action. He had a test 100 too.
Yeah.
Just a great servant, but... Andy Flower. Interesting enough, Andy Flower is also the one credited with having invented the reverse sweep.
Ooh, beautiful.
Now, I haven't verified this, but I do remember Jimmy Adams used to play reverse sweep as well.
I see.
But the Jimmy Adams reverse sweep was slightly different. He would actually play it with the back of his bat, and it would be like a little tickle just behind the keeper kind of thing. It was just a release shot. Just, I want to rotate strike.
Yeah.
But... the reverse sweep, as we see it, of the Maxwellian era, of the reverse sweep not becoming a little tickle, but the reverse sweep actually being a boundary and then...
a six.
And now a six-hitting zone. I think Andy Flower was the one who is credited with inventing that
stroke. Great call.
And Titan in a team of minnows.
Yes.
Right? So I think he and also his coaching career. Don't forget that. He's achieved things as a coach that many people have not in their lifetime. Shakib from Bangladesh.
Shakib Al-Hassan.
The easiest choice. I mean, he may or may not be your most favorite cricketer, but the man has done some incredible things for that team, whether it's with bat, his ball, with the ball, he's just an outstanding bowler.
Yeah.
World-class bowler and a really top-notch batsman.
Love it.
Shakib, very thing. Rashid Khan, I think he's turning 16 next week. Rashid Khan, I mean, he is the guy. Look, if Shane Warne thinks you're an incredible talent, you're an incredible talent. But it's not just the hype. Like, I've seen him deliver now in so many leagues, in so many matches, and even for Afghanistan, I've seen him deliver. Like, and he's got so many varieties, and he works on it, he practices. These three, I think, are pretty standard.
Yes.
The next two, I just thought, I had to pick one curly one. Otherwise, what's the point of a podcast? If a singular act on a cricket field is worthy, then I believe I'm going to pick Dwayne Levrock. Tell me the team and tell me the act.
Is it Bermuda?
Yes.
And no one forget the 2007, that slip sketch.
Yes, that's right. I mean, come on.
You got to listen to the David Lloyd commentary at the time.
I do. I mean, like that man with that single action has put the entire country as a cricketing nation on the map. Like, surely that deserves something. I thought I'll pick a little curly one.
Yes.
Another one, it would be Colin Zaboya from Kenya.
Oh, Colin Zaboya, okay.
How many associate nation cricketers can say that I bowled my team into a World Cup semi-final?
Love that. Not many.
Right, so I think he, and the fact that, you know, if memory serves me correctly, India didn't have it all their way in that semi as well. I believe a Ganguly 100 kind of pulled them, and it was a laboured 100.
Ganguly
doesn't make many laboured 100s, and it was...
It wasn't easy. I think India scores 270 in that. Yeah. And, on another day, maybe Kenya get some luck and they chase that. But Colin Zaboya is a good pick. The reason I wanted you to pick these is because I want our listeners to just get a sense of... Cricket is about some of the stronger nations and watching and celebrating Australia, England, South Africa, India, Pakistan. But it's also about appreciating that there are other nations out there that are keeping the game afloat, keeping the game popular.
Yeah.
And we need to celebrate those players. You said Andy Flower. He was in mine. He's a batting average of 50 for Zimbabwe, playing some of the best nations in the world. Can't argue with Shakib Al-Hassan. I love your Levrock pick. I had a couple others. I just wanted to give a shout out to. I had Steve Tokolo, who was the captain for Kenya, oversaw their successful 2003, captain Kenya in 99. Was a very strong, solid Kenyan batsman. Yep. I wanted to give a shout out to Kevin O'Brien from Ireland.
Yep.
Look at his stats. He's not the greatest cricketer of all time, but he is responsible for one of the most successful ODI run chases and scoring a fantastic 100 against England. So rather than saying he's one of the greatest associate nation cricketers, I would say he played one of the greatest associate nation innings I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And
just on that,
since
we've touched Ireland, maybe this may be a touchy topic, but how do we rank Owen Morgan?
You've got to put him as an Englishman, unfortunately, because
really?
he's the Kepler Wessels of it is interesting that, like, Ireland...
Okay, Kepler's slightly different,
I know,
I would say.
I know, but Ireland is a fairly... If I use a rugby terminology, Ireland is a very successful rugby nation, and you don't see players in Ireland moving to other countries.
Yep.
It's just interesting that from a cricket perspective, perhaps they just don't have the money to keep these players, but if you've got players like Owen Morgan in your system, you've got to keep them.
Yeah.
They can't be going and playing for England. Yeah. And
I don't think it was their choice, to be honest. That's the point that I wanted to make.
Yeah.
Also about why these nations don't come up is also because maybe it's easier for them to move to the bigger nations, and there are, you know, so that's another discussion point. But anyway,
And the last one I just want to give a special mention to, I'm not calling him great, but I remember him through my childhood, John Davison for Canada.
Yes, I thought about this. 36 ball 100.
If you watch the 2003 World Cup, he scores a sensational 100 against the West Indies. He also scores a 70 innings against New Zealand. But the one against West Indies is great. Canada is almost, they're 120 on the board, and John Davison has already scored 100. Dean Jones in the box is saying, what are they going to do now? Make him prime minister. It's a moment. It's worth celebrating. I thought we should do that. I had a lot of fun thinking about these cricketers.
Yeah.
I want to finish with this, which is you raised it early in our episode, which was talking about the current state of the game and how are there fixes or how do we fix this this bottleneck situation at the moment, which is that the cricket calendar is jammed with cricket. Self-interests are, a lot of these countries are prioritizing their 2020 leagues ahead of test cricket, and one day cricket is now at the, sort of falling down the priority list.
Mm.
Is there an issue with the game, or are we just making a mountain out of a molehill at the moment?
To be honest, I thought that the ODIs were really declining until this last World Cup. I think this last World Cup has... Maybe this is just subjective. I haven't heard from other people.
Yeah.
To me, this last World Cup was actually reinvigorated my love for the 50-over game. Maybe because my team won the World Cup. I'm not sure. But it was just like, I thought that the matches in this World Cup were pretty competitive, and I liked all of that. The problem with 50 overs is I can see some people now saying, okay, you know what, you should make it 40 overs. But you made 50 over cricket because test cricket was too long, and now you're going to make it 40 overs, then you're going to make it 30 overs. There's already T20 and there's already a T10 league. What are you going to do next? All right, guys, come in, we'll toss the coin. All right, whoever wins the match and go home. Like, what's the point? Like, you can't just also just keep creating formats and then complain that the calendar is also congested. I'm not entirely sure. And I think also this whole decline of test cricket, and you have to look at that. I don't think that test cricket is declining in the SENA nations and India, barring South Africa, right? If you pick Australia, England, New Zealand and India, test cricket is as healthy as it has ever been. Without a doubt. Now, would you say, but then within that league, would you look at New Zealand and go, well, they don't get the same attendance as Australia? Yeah, but that's also because they got a much lesser population. It's also nowhere near their number one sport. It's like their number one sport is rugby union. Number two sport is rugby union. Then there's cricket, right?
Yeah.
So you've got to also factor those sorts of things, those things in as well. So I think what can be done for the game, I think the first thing is this whole nonsense of having two match series or one match series is just wrong. I think we need to do that. And if that's the case, and if we're going to say, well, something has to go, then I think we can also look at moving towards test and T20.
Yeah.
If we did that, and I think other things is 100%, I think the ICC has got to, well, to act like an actual entity and actually get in and first of all pull up these boards that are acting in their self-interest. I really love the idea of cricket in the Olympics, but if you want to do that, in order to make cricket an Olympic sport, you can't just have 10 countries playing. You have to take the game out. I know that they're doing part of the cricket in the US, but guess what's happening? It's just Indians in the US are going to come and watch, right? Like, let's not think of this some global expansion plan that's going to Pluto. They're just literally more of the same people that used to follow the cricket, like whether it's Indians or Pakistanis or Sri Lankans from Sri Lanka and all of these places. They're just going to go and watch this in the US.
You know what they need? They need China to take up cricket. If China takes up cricket, it'll help with the whole, well, add a billion to the viewership numbers, but the attempt for global expansion.
But can you just imagine, as a side note, the geopolitical implications of, you know, BCCI butting heads with the Chinese board for who gets control of the money? Can you just imagine what's going to happen? Are you going to start another war with this?
I'm talking risky there. You're right.
Yeah.
The point you mentioned about two tests, three tests is a well-made one. Yep. It's the detractors or critics of that will say, okay, so Mangan, you want three tests all the time, but then are you going to be the one that's what? Are you going to turn on the TV when West Indies tours Bangladesh or West Indies goes to New Zealand and plays a three-test series in front of four people? Are you going to watch that? That's the argument against that, which 100%. Is, does the viewing public want to watch lesser quality games being played over a longer period of time? I don't know if there's an answer to that. Perhaps the answer is that, yes, we still need to play those games because ultimately within that, there will be storylines that are created. Players will emerge, players get experience, and they become better for it in the long run.
Well, I'll come back to you on that first discussion point, which is, will I be the one watching it? My question is, has a sport only been about viewership and money? Right? We know, for instance, that every Bugatti that's made, the company makes a loss when they sell it. Right? We know that we know that there's certain things that people do at a loss because it's important for the greater thing. My thing is, you make your money in T20, but you invest in Test cricket. Because when you invest in Test cricket, the thing is, the idea is that you're not going to see the results straight away. But if you invest that same amount, the problem that everybody's trying to do is that they'll be like, I'm just going to chase the money. I'm just going to make the money straight away. I'm just going to, okay, this solves my problem. And guess what? I won't be on the board next in the next 5 years. If you're in Pakistan, you'll be on the board in the morning. You'll be off the board at 11 o'clock. Then you'll form another breakaway board at 3 p.m.
Then you get kicked off.
Then you get kicked off that board. And then you start another. If you're in Sri Lanka, it's like one day you're on the board. Then the minister says his son's on the board. Like every country's got its own its own problems, right? Like, the problem is, I think most of these boards are administered. They're administered so poorly. They're not done. Like, for instance, most of these guys, like, it's mainly ex-cricketers who, you know, don't have a lot of these kind of commercial backgrounds who can look at things other than the deeper levels of it. But at the same time, you also don't want it to be like what's happened sometimes at CA has been that it's been run by administrators who also don't have the heart of the players.
I was going to ask you that, because don't love Test cricket, then
you need to have the both. You need to have a good balance within the administrators, and you need to have that balance at the ICC level where you should have a CEO who doesn't have anything about cricket, but is an incredible CEO and fantastic at their job. Then there should be an advisory person who is who's played cricket at the highest level. And you need to have that balance there.
Love it.
I think if you do that, structure it at the administrative level first, and you do that, then people come to realize and go, and everybody gets together and go, Test cricket is the pinnacle of cricket. It is how we started.
Yes.
You can never have cricket without Test cricket, is my opinion, right? All of the razzle-dazzle. So my thing is, you make the money, you get the audience, and then you try and push that back to what is your core product, which has to be Test cricket. I think that's one thing. Getting more associate nations. I also do agree that you can't devalue the quality of Test cricket.
Mm.
So you can't just go in and, you know, hand out Test nationship to other countries. But maybe what we can do is that we can actually start to have like these qualification leagues, the same way that, you know, we are now doing for ODI, and maybe give them like de facto first class status.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it could be like, I don't know, Namibia playing Canada, or like, and they're playing each other regularly. So if they're not able to play against the big boys, at least they're playing in the leagues with the next closest thing, and they're playing each other regularly, then the overall level will increase. The overall quality of their playing will increase. And sure, like, but then, like, if you look at Afghanistan, they're not completely out of depth in Test cricket.
No, they're actually not.
Punch on. They're okay. They're not the greatest, but they're okay.
And sometimes you only improve by playing more and just playing with more frequencies. It's a great call.
Yep.
I leave today with more optimism after hearing your words and your wisdom, because I think sometimes we get caught up in the bubble of saying everything's dying and it's not the same as the ones before, but we can appreciate that it's just a different game now. It's a different sport with different athletes. We are still enjoying the game for what it is. We're lucky that we live in Australia and we get to watch high quality sport and high quality cricket.
Yep.
But Subhangin, I thought that was a great way to recap what's been a beautiful game for us, and perhaps what is a rosy future if the game's administrators get it right. But otherwise, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.